Hey, I always shake my head when I do that because there's like that voice of dystopia recording in progress. It's like,
Right.
ah.
The
So, right,
machine.
the machine, right? Where hopefully we can use the tools of machine against itself. Hey, everybody, here we are. I'm Tom, the Tom Lynn Show, as it were. I don't know. What really to call this these conversations that I've been having with people. But today I have, and he's been with us on other occasions, the great Mike Whistler of the Easy Peasy Podcast. And also we might talk about this a little bit as well, the WTF Forum, which is a sort of loosely affiliated group of people having similar conversations. But actually, I was listening to the WTF forum last week with Mike and some other guests, whom you can enumerate. And amongst the themes that emerge there is the suggestion of the occult and occult imaginings, perhaps playing into the mentality, the disposition, the inclination of the elite characters that they're the characters that inhabit the elite, the so-called elite stratum of society. And this constellation of questions, the occult, the magical, and the technological, right? These are all things that that have been coming up. And I thought maybe, we could have Michael back on and maybe we can just sort of shoot the breeze around this. It's not highly structured. It's just, we're just talking. And Mike also, I was kind enough to check out, I think, the interview with James Tunney and maybe also with Guido Paparotta. But Mike, how's it going?
Good man, good to be here. I watched those videos you sent me and I read that essay. And I found it encouraging because it seems like you've been exploring kind of similar topics to me as of late. I enjoyed both of those interviews immensely. I couldn't help but think that both of those guys are really onto something. And I jotted down a few notes, so I do have a, I might turn the tables on you. I know we're kind of on your show, but I may,
Well,
with your permission, I may use this
no, it's a
audio as well for
conversation.
my show.
Absolutely.
Right, but
Absolutely.
I've got a few sort of thoughts, right, after listening to those previous chats. Speaking of not knowing what to call your show, I mean, I would almost just say like chats with Thinking Tom or something simple, right? Call it what it is, I guess, right? Yeah. But anyways, I'm looking forward to chatting about it. Like I did not give a whole lot of credence to the occult. I've watched a whole bunch of movies and, never like took it too awful serious, right? As far as the forces behind the curtain, so to speak. And until I'll say till COVID times, right? Where it just felt like something is going on here that just isn't right. There's like clearly I don't know, an unforeseen or an unseen force at play where it seems like evil has more of a grip on our power structure than I ever really considered, even though I was already like pretty much there as an anarchist. I was already there before COVID, but it just kind of pushed me over the edge of thinking, man, like I think there really are like people that are influenced by evil in this world. And if that's the case, then there must be something on the opposite. So I'm trying
Well,
to,
I
I'm,
mean, we're just jumping into the deep end there as
yeah,
to
a little bit.
the nature the question of evil, evil broadly, human evil. It's crucial at the outset to indicate that the conjecture that we're now the only game in town, that there are other elements or energies or forces or entities in pressing themselves in some way upon the reality. That conjecture does not, and I'm not saying this in virtue of you, but I had this conversation with someone else the other night. It is not to alleviate our responsibility as human beings. Actually, if anything, I think it heightens our responsibility. Of course, from one standpoint, we must confess at the beginning that these conjectures are going to be resistant to strict evidencing. So just to speak from where I'm standing, there are certain actions that have transpired in history that are so unequivocally evil that whilst human beings were instrumental in their execution, I cannot but imagine that there is something other than human involved in their conception. So specifically, to give a concrete example, I can point to nuclear weaponry. To me, the use of the atomic bomb, the development, the implementation of that technology is fundamentally diabolical. And the full stop. There's no justifying a nuclear weapon. Mm-hmm. None. All right. The apologies which is for are offered are paltry and inadequate. And it's an example of where I think you see the injection of something genuinely evil into human history. And we, you know, I mean, as human beings that built the bomb, as human beings that dropped the bomb, but it just seems like a more or rather less than human reality is driving something like that. And connected to that is the notion that the stage of history is a contest of moral energy, and that we play a vital role in its outcome. This is, of course, not exactly a perspective which is going to be amenable to relay on NPR, but that is that's where I stand in any event. But as you said, it was the onset of the situation, the lockdowns, the masking, the injections, the abetted medical tyranny of the past 3 years, the deceptions involved in that, which inspired in you a sense that there's something else afoot. Do you want to sort of elaborate upon that point?
Yeah, I mean, it finally just kind of clicked where it's like there's a spiritual battle at play in a nutshell. And there's a whole lot of people who try their best to be neutral to the spiritual battle, but by virtue of neutrality end up kind of giving in to the dark, in my opinion. And we are kind of like jumping right into the meat of it. You know, I'm very interested in the question that you had with, I want to say, what's his name? Guido
Preparata.
Yeah. About sort of whether or not technology is amoral, or if there's sort of maybe an evil aspect to it. And I appreciated that you interjected that, like, it certainly depends, right? But it got me thinking about, you know, my favorite author personally is Edward Abbey. And he wrote about what he called the megalomaniacal mega machine. It's a bit of a tongue twister. Megalomaniacal
mega machine, right?
Yeah, yeah. And how, you know, the battle he was fighting in this one particular book, it's called The Monkey Wrench Gang. Mm-hmm. It was never against people. Like the heroes of the story went out of their way not to hurt people. And it was all about fighting the apparatus, the machine, right? And I've always been attracted to those kind of stories just from a gut level, you know, like the story of the hero against the big system, right? And it just is starting to feel like that's sort of what's happening. Not sort of, like pretty much entirely. You were talking about different movies and different stories that sort of align with what we're going through now. And I feel like it can't really be understated that, yeah, like people sort of are at this turning point where you can either go with the program or sort of rise up against it. And me personally, I'm trying to rise up against it, you know?
Yeah, and there is, as I recall, there's a little bit of difference between Guido and myself on that score. It might just have been really a difference of emphasis, because his concern mm-hmm. was that if you put too much weight into the influence of these technologies on us, you discount the reality that we still make decisions. I think mm-hmm. the example of which he's fond is the cell phone, which, you know, is obviously insidious, but at the end of the day, we have the capacity not to be checking our notifications. You know, you can change the settings on your phone so it's not as egregiously intrusive and so forth, right? And that's just an example. The point is that we're not completely manacled to the apparatus. And you have to make that explicit, because if you capitulate too early, then you create an excuse for passivity. I suppose the point of difference between myself and him on this point is that I really do think that the technological mentality is just insidious in its ability to unfold us within its logic, even when we are trying to resist it. And that's why I think it's something that needs to be given direct and significant attention. So, you know, where to go from there with it? You know, I really need to have read The Monkey Wrench Gang. I haven't yet, but I need
to. Oh, man. You know, it's a fun, it's basically just a fun read. It's kind of an adventure novel, which is sort of what I went for. I don't know if we've spoke since I put out my novel.
You were just releasing it, I think, the first time we spoke.
But I went for a similar kind of aesthetic or feel, in that it's action adventure with a whole lot of sort of metaphor behind it. And
you can, anywho, if you want, recap like the main theme of your novel.
Well, it's very much a man against the machine kind of thing, but there's a spiritual component behind it where the setting more or less is a post global blackout. Like a handful of years after the blackout, to where people have sort of more localized energy grids, and like they're rebuilding after just a massive disaster. And the main character is trying to get a more or less national podcast going for the first time since, trying to disseminate sort of useful information to people on the ground in a very divided and like fractured North America. And I don't know. Yeah, I don't want to give too much away about the story, but it's very much like the powers that be still exist and are still trying to assert dominance, and a small group of intrepid people are rising up against it. And I think that's just a tale as old as time, and it sort of is true of our nature. You know, so many folks will passively consent to the mega machine until it gets out of control, and then it takes effort to fight it back, you know, to beat it down, to at least strive for some level of balance. And you know, technology is a huge part of it, right? Like, and it has been for a good portion of our recent history. I've been very intrigued by Kurt Vonnegut's, I just started reading it, I'm not very far in, but Player Piano, where he's touching on sort of the rapid technological development of America. And this was some years ago. I think he wrote it in the 50s, maybe, or 60s, but it takes place during sort of what he calls the early stages of the third industrial revolution, right? And it was when, you know, if the first industrial revolution was sort of mechanization, and the second was sort of cheap energy, right? Internal combustion. And so it went from saving manpower, you know, muscle power, to saving like routine labor. You know, the third in his mind would be saving the issue of thought work, right? Of mental work, of creative work. You know, the engineers, the scientists, they would all be replaced by, you know, the machine as well. And I think, you know, people now say we're in the fourth industrial revolution, but it doesn't quite line up the same as Kurt Vonnegut's image. I don't know the exact definitions, but I guess now, right, the digital age, the communication age. And it's been very rapid, and people are not quite accustomed or evolved for it. Like, it's very, well, it can be very overwhelming and addictive in so many ways. We get addicted to convenience, to entertainment, to quick dopamine. And you're right. It takes is self-control to not be at the whim of the phone, we'll say. But that's harder than it sounds for a lot of folks.
Well, it's difficult for a number of reasons. I mean, there's the nature of the screens. The Player Piano is like an interesting, like, I haven't read that book by Vonnegut, right? But if I consider like the artifact of the Player Piano as something upon which to meditate, where you have a piece that produces music without human involvement automatically. It's emblematic of, you know, this process of surrender to systematic process. Like, you no longer need the pianist, right? You can look at how that foreshadows, anticipates the present situation, where you have these software modalities, like most recently ChatGPT is getting lots of buzz, but that's just kind of like the software du jour. The point is that all of these technologies are giving away actual human creativity, right? As a writer, it's a kind of obscene, really, that you are going to employ a machine to manufacture. I don't even like using the word manufacture, to synthesize a set of words that you will then integrate into your writing, But what ends up happening is that you become captured by the machine because you will end up accommodating your own composition so as that it dovetails more simply or more smoothly with the underlying stylistics of the machine's algorithm. So then you don't longer need an author. In other words, everything which we have conceived as culture artistically is in principle going to then be manufactured. I don't want to use that word again, because the reason I don't want to use the word manufacture,
I think it's a fair word.
It's fair, but like its etymology is like that you're making it by hand. So there's
no, not necessarily.
But you have this like rootedness in the concrete. It's like an aesthetic reticence on my part, because I don't want to give the machine any credit more than it synthesizes, it regurgitates, it regurgitates output.
Yeah.
And the illusion arises that we will no longer need people to have culture, because the machines will create the culture for us. Mm. Actually, I'm only arriving at that conclusion in this very moment, but that's the logical outcome of this, of these iterations. This is actually also the argument of Jacques Ellul in The Technological Society, is that the technological mentality is consummated in the elimination of the human, because the principle is one of absolute efficiency. And right, an aspect right. of the human is that we are not absolutely efficient. And that's a good thing, because vital life process resists the entropy, which means that it has a joie de vivre, an adventure, an energy to it that can't be contained by something which is just routinized by, technicized by the softwares, right? Of course, the other side of the equation is that you can't throw the baby out with the bathwater. You have to come to some sort of relationship with technologies. So it's an important distinction between singular technology, singular machines, and the technological mentality that wants to subsume everything we do under a logic of problem solution. I don't know if this is helpful. I feel like I should.
No. I can interject in that. The player piano is a really cool metaphor, because it kind of summarizes almost like our technology up to even this point, in that it's a recording of sorts that mimics the work of a person, but on a mass scale, right? So there, with the player piano, like there at one point was a person who sat down at the keys and recorded that initial scroll, right? And that scroll would be reproduced and run through the mechanical device to reproduce it as if a ghost pianist was sitting there plucking at the keys. You know, the keys would actually move up and down. And In the novel, there the character you kind of follow, at least initially, is working as an engineer in a large scale, you know, mechanized factory in the early days of automation, right? And there's a section of one of the factory's buildings that is going kind of faulty, right, by way of entropy. And It's a series of lathes that are reproducing the movements of the most skilled lathe operator from 20 years before, right? The person who eventually was fired sort of for his own, you know, after performing the performance he was asked to perform, they had it on tape and they were able to reproduce it on a series of, you know, dozens of machines and produce 1,000 times more units than he was able to do in a day, right? And it's just sort of it's a metaphor for where we are now, where sort of like y'all talked about the cyber plantation, right?
Right.
And how, like, so we got to a point where people were no longer needed for their physical work. So what do? They do service jobs, they do, sales jobs, but like all the manufacturing is done by sort of automated systems for the, you know, majority. And what's sad about it, and what the novel kind of touches on, like he runs into the craftsman who is now 80 some years old. And it's sort of like the old man is dying at the same time as his automation, and there's no craftsman left. So how do they, you know, it's sort of this catch 22 of you replace people, but then there's no people left to replace the machine when it breaks, or to fix the machine because the knowledge is lost.
Well, you know, what strikes me about that tableau is how it speaks to the challenge of generational division. So historically, and I think they've done a better job of preserving this facet of civilization than we have in the West. But historically, there is this concept of transmission, of apprenticeship, of parentage, of passing things on from one generation to the next. There, the process of learning is given a kind of sacred space in the casual rituals of a culture. I say casual rituals because it's just sort of how people got on with things. But now we're at an impasse where the temptation is to see every generation as at odds with the generation that came before it. And it's become, that's fine as far as it goes. There's always going to be some tensions between parents and children and so forth, right? But historically, those tensions did not get in the way of this relay of ways of life onto the young. And it feels like this is what has been lost, because our culture has been reconstellated so that we're radically atomized. The family is considered to be almost vestigial and just sort of occasions the production of new spawn that will eventually be conditioned to, you know, serve for the reproduction of the economy. We have become the means, the instrument, and the degradation. I mean, this is kind of crazy me saying this because I'm hardly a traditionalist, right? But you have a corrosion of the familial, both in the sense of family biologically, but also in the sense of how people just related with each other. It puts me in mind of Ivan Illich, and he makes some remarks in Tools for Conviviality and elsewhere about and deschooling society, about the invention of childhood, and that childhood, as we understand it, is a construction of relatively recent provenance. Even into like the early 20th century, you know, you didn't have this demarcation between a child and adult in the sense that we do. Children, especially if they're raised on a farm, just sort of grew into doing things somewhat organically, you know, right. So that by the time they were 12 or 13, they were effectively an adult, and it's most obvious with farming, but that's just because it's sort of clear because the accidents of that discipline, it's not just a farming thing. That's how all human skills got passed on through similar arrangements like apprenticeships, you know, Michelangelo had it.
Or you go back, as far as like hunter gatherer, you know,
right.
history where it was essential to have skills to survive. And, you know, as soon as a kid could walk, they were learning things that were useful for survival. And yeah, I like the, I mean, I don't like it, but the sort of phrase of the invention of childhood, you know, I call it like perpetual adolescence, where we expect so little of our young adults. Like they're so incapable. They're so incompetent. And it's a shame because it takes another 10 years before they learn how to be effective adults, when it shouldn't be that long of a process. I think the disease is sort of our addiction to convenience in a lot of ways, and guidance, and not having to, not having to make decisions for ourselves too often, right? As far as how am I going to educate my child? Well, that decision was made for me. I'll put them in the state facility. And, you know, how am I going to get food? Well, I'll have to get a job, a steady job, and I'll have to work 40 hours a week. You know, we've lost the ability to be craftsmen in a lot of ways, or just in general, just skilled humans. We traded in comfort and convenience for like skill and artisanship and ability and, fill in the blank. But I think this is the dark side, of technology, where as much as I love it for what it is, I get hot showers and I can talk to interesting people that live nowhere near me. But there's a dark side to it where I almost see most people are just so hooked, right? They're so hooked and they consent to it, right? The user agreement is kind of a funny thing to meditate on, right? You sign it without even reading it because it's 1,000 fucking pages long, and you're basically signing away your privacy, your autonomy, your responsibility. And people do it without a second thought because, well, I'd rather just be able to use XYZ computer, program, app, whatever you want to call it. And we then get to the point where we can't even imagine life without it, which is why I think it's kind of guided in some ways by dark forces. It's kind of evil in that it's like any other sort of addictive drug. It creates sort of victims out of its users. That's not to say they don't have a part in that happening, right? That they're not somewhat responsible, but we put these phones in our kids' hands at the age of, 5 years old and let them play Bubble Crush. And next thing you know, they're a gambling addict in Vegas, down on their luck, and they're, depressed and have no way out. I mean, it's no different, right? It's getting hooked on the dopamine of entertainment and convenience. So I kind of advocate for people to seek out a more traditional life. I think it's really important to at least know where your food comes from, if not grow it yourself. Because if you don't, you are a slave to their system. You have to buy from the grocery store. I think if you're dependent on the electric grid, you're kind of a slave to the electric company. And
go on.
I was just going to say, don't get me started on income tax. We are essentially hamsters on the wheel of the great machine, charging its batteries. But we give consent. That's the problem. Well, we allow it.
So there's like a few points there that I'd like to raise. We do give consent, but I just want to note that in many respects, it's coerced consent, right? Yeah. Because many people are in situations where they, for all intents and purposes, have to agree to the use of this technology just to pay the mortgage, proverbially speaking, because we've been so immersed in it. So that actually, in a way, kind of negates the legal force of the contract. I'm not saying this would actually hold up in court, but contracts signed under coercive conditions are nullified in virtue of that, in virtue of those coercive conditions, right? Mm-hmm. So this is not to say that I am saying, well, I had to do it. I'm just saying that it's a factor that needs to be considered in evaluating how to navigate from where we are now to where we want to go. Also, you have to, I think, examine the question of where do we want to go practically? And I hate being the guy to like raise this question, right? Because it doesn't seem like, maybe I'm wrong here, we can all just suddenly like move out of the city and get a homestead and so forth, right? We have to imagine ways of living that, for example, can be integrated into urban environments. And, you know, it doesn't seem like we have to forsake altogether the benefits of certain scales of organization, right?
Certain conveniences, certain efficiencies. No, I agree. Some technology like is very sewer useful.
Systems, for example.
Right.
I don't know. Like a lot of times I'll start and look into something. And then when you like get into it, when you actually get into it, it's kind of crazy what unfolds, right? Like I haven't looked into, you know, how does the city of Los Angeles provide all of its inhabitants with potable water? And how do you, you know, navigate the question of moving beyond the aspects of that system, which are problematic, to put it very politely?
Well, there's always the grand, like impossible to answer questions of sort of anarchistic thought play, right? You know, how would we do this? How would we do that? It's a matter of, to me, and I think you touched on it with Guido, where it's kind of the miracle of self-organization, right? And we've unfortunately lost that as a skill as well. But it's a simple matter of creating local economies, like intentionally creating local economies and making that a priority, in that if we want to be sovereign, if we want to live free, we have to have our own support systems figured out. You know, that starts with food, that starts with water, that starts with the ability to, you know, provide basic needs, medical, you know, XYZ. And so it's, you can't solve any of these issues overnight, but what you do is if you want that in your life, if you want that resiliency, if you want that community, that economy that you can depend on, you have to just do it a little at a time. Right. And I don't see any other way out.
The only way out is through.
Right. Exactly. I mean,
and the reality is the need for action on local and municipal level. Mm-hmm. And so this is where you run into like, well, it's not very sexy.
No, right? It's really not. It's supporting your local farmer. It's meeting your neighbors. It's, you know, buying from the local restaurant instead of the chain restaurant. It's as simple as that.
Oh, it is that simple.
Yeah. I mean, and I am a little bit afraid of just the direction technology is going, because I think we're going to sort of go the way of, I mean, we already are, like technocracy. And, you know, you will read what we allow you to read. You'll vote how we tell you to vote. It's very much already a reality, which is, you know, me personally, I think it's sort of a spiritual thing to decide I am in any way I possibly can going to cease giving consent to the mega machine. I'm going to stop voting for the lesser of two evils. I'm going to, you know, fill in the blank. I'm going to support my local farm instead of some Monsanto, you know, Bill Gates owned mega farm. And I don't know. It's like a spiritual battle of how you spend your money, how you spend your time, how you spend your thoughts. Right.
Absolutely. I mean, it strikes me that, you know, and there's like an element of faith, like maybe that it, from some vantages that might seem just like futility, but it's really irrelevant actually if you succeed, because the point is that you are making a statement about what human being is. Now, I think we can draw hope from other quarters. One being that the rhetoric notwithstanding, technocracy is not ultimately feasible. It leads to situations like that outlined in Player Piano. And also, it's just so deeply inhuman and regressive that it will invite the creation of counter energies, right? Oppression breeds resistance. And existentially, as human beings, not all of us are just going to fold like a cheap suit with respect to these trajectories. And really, the key is in aggregating these small acts of defiance. I was talking earlier with another friend, Nick Bascom, and one thing we can do when we're using a word processor is to just turn off the spell check and turn off the grammar check. Like, I mean, that's
interesting.
Like pretty just, like
just to allow it to be a bit more real, a bit more human.
Right.
Obviously not ChatGPT because there's mistakes.
Exactly. Or you could just go all the way and use a typewriter.
Right.
But short of using a typewriter, you no longer are constantly acquiescing, or, you know, something that's really kind of radical is just not using GPS. Right.
Absolutely. You know, yeah.
Just actually learn how to get around where you live. Okay, without relying on GPS. And let's, you know, I mean, I'll be honest, it's pretty handy. It's pretty handy. I'm not going to pretend like it isn't. Okay.
If your phone's dead, how are you going to get home if you really don't know how to get around town? Yeah.
Right. And it also, that like has to do with the sense of actual concrete locality.
Yeah. You know, it's called sense of place. A lot of people couldn't tell you their nearest creek or their nearest lake or the highest point within 20 miles, you know, even though in reality that can be useful. And golly, let alone you ask somebody even in like a clear day where the sun is visible, hey, what direction is, you know, which way is north? A lot of people couldn't figure it out. And that's kind of, it's one of our most basic survival skills, like sense of place. Where am I? Where's water? Where's food? Where's my family?
I almost don't want to use the word survival because that sort of suggests like a desperation that you're in.
Well, maybe we call it like a psychological need then.
It is a need. Right. Yeah. You know, to me, it's just being in relationship with the actual world around you, like that,
right.
The concrete, right? So, so like, I live in an urban environment. I'm kind of an urban creature, right? It's distressing, right? That even the urban is sort of the reliance on these sort of technologies. Like, really, it's kind of crazy. It's like you don't actually live in real space anymore. You live in a virtual space and the real space is an occasion to navigate the virtual space. It's nuts. It's nuts. I mean, I guess what you really come down to is just saying no more as far as possible. Mm-hmm. But then, like, you know, you have to come into some kind of relationship with the machine.
I enjoyed sort of the wordplay that was going on in your interview where he was talking about how even the terminology we use, right? If we're going back to this idea of like the cyber plantation, like turning us into sort of just workers who feed the beast with our digital dollars in the form of taxation and general like production. This idea of the language that gets used, right? Like it's a server farm. They call them like, you know, manufacturing plants. Like, you know, it's just kind of funny how we can't really escape the natural language of production, but we're separating ourselves from it in many ways. Or at least, you know, I don't know if I'm making a whole lot of sense, but again, it's kind of like
that's
leading towards
it's an illusion.
Leading towards like when do we lose the ability to be human, right? To be sort of naturally human. The whole transhumanism movement is just scary.
Yes, it is. Now, at the outset, I mean, I'm going to have a guy on my show here in a few weeks. I have to set it up, but I met him recently. And he's a exponent of this transhumanist position. And his view is that this doesn't direct connectly to what we're saying, but it all hangs together ultimately, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, just to finish the point, his position is that aging is a disease. I think I mentioned that I met this guy yesterday. The aging right. is a disease that needs to be cured, and that it's a conceit to pretend it's an inevitability. Or to pretend that death is an inevitability, that with adequate technical intervention, we can live in perpetuity.
You know, I met a gal the other day who said, my husband is a scientist. He's going to keep our dogs alive forever. I said, you're out of your damn mind. You know?
Yeah, this connects to like the spiritual questions in a very real right. way, because in a sense, the spiritual is also intimately concerned with the question of our own mortality and how we're going to relate to that mortality. But it also connects to the issue of the magical and its relationship to the technological and the occult. Mm-hmm. Right. The drawback to like the beginning and what is being conjured, if you like, with the proliferation of these technologies.
I was going to say, I know you listened to our WTF forum recently, and we kind of got into the occult stuff. And whether or not to take it seriously, we're talking about this place called Center of the Earth or Center of the World. And I said, I don't think I would want to walk on those grounds. I get a very like sinister vibe as far as the layout, the symbology, symbolism, whatever you know, all of the different structures and the way they were laid out. And I'm just... Again, like I wouldn't have said that maybe a handful of years ago. I wasn't concerned with sort of whether or not there were evil places on Earth, right? Despite all of the ghost stories and haunted houses and whatever, I didn't take it too seriously, but anymore I kind of do. And I don't know, you got to wonder if just the proliferation of information is sort of dangerous in its own right, where people seek out excuses to no longer have faith, you know, via knowledge, right? Being able to eat from the tree of knowledge every single day and try to like order our world instead of sort of admitting that in some ways we are, you know, we're helpless to some degree, and faith in God being like cast aside as an archaic idea, like we have the technology, we no longer need God.
That, I mean, I think a useful distinction there would be that between the proliferation of information and the proliferation of knowledge, right? Because information is undisciplined. It's data, and it's not bound by a sense of context, so that it is very amenable to abuse. Whereas knowledge, or the dignity of the term knowledge, implies a kind of discipline, a sense of context, a sense of the appropriate usage of what is being learned or apprehended by the student, as it were. But that is sort of a cultural formation, right? You could, it might even be advantageous to elucidate what we mean by the word information, right? The word information, I think, co-arises with certain developments in communication theory, even in the early 20th century. And it's the, you can measure the amount of information in a message vis-a-vis the extent to which that message is amenable to digital translation. That's what bits and bytes and kilobytes and terabytes and all that. That is all, those are all measures of information, which is an analysis of the degree to which a message, and here by a message, we just really mean a series of discrete symbols like letters. It doesn't have to be letters, it could be sounds or graphics, right? Okay. Into a format which is mathematizable and then relayable across a channel, whether that channel is noisy or noiseless, right? That's where, so when you look at the actual concept of information, what you're dealing with is mere formatting. It's a formatting question. It's an engineering question. And it is indifferent to the content of the message. So the fact that we have sort of given the notion of information so much weight in our culture is consistent with that this culture has also forgotten the importance of knowledge as opposed and content as opposed to mere form. I say that because, you know, because I feel like we have to be disciplined. It's, and the problem isn't even really the proliferation of information per se. It's that it's proliferated in a way which makes it very difficult for anyone to reasonably use it. Like in the sense that they're being reasonable, that they're using their reason, their rational faculties. But you're also touching on another thing, and that is that the secular universe in which we live doesn't want to give space for something transcendent. Doesn't even have to be a god or gods per se, but just an acknowledgement that there is something about reality that exceeds our capacity. Man's reach exceeds his grasp, right? You know, and integrating that into how we engage the process of life itself. See, that's really it, right? Because if you try to understand everything in your life just as a problem to be solved, you're going to be an absolutely miserable person, okay? Mm-hmm. And you're probably going to make things miserable for people around you as well. Real like living has to assimilate the reality of mystery into the decisions that we make along the way.
Yeah. I feel like the player piano is like a really good metaphor, because the sound might be the same more or less as the original performer who recorded his finger movements. But just because you can replay that sound over and over again doesn't mean there's soul to it the way there was when the person first played the keys. And if you never, you know, if say you make the job of the piano player somewhat obsolete, you lose all kinds of potential for improvisation and adaptation and new sounds and new songs and new creativity. I don't know. Like, I think the simple solution to this spiritual battle is to reintroduce community into the equation, right? And this is why I think there's sort of a demonic force at play in that it seems like there is an active attempt to separate people currently, right? To divide us, to make us helpless, to destroy the community, destroy the family, destroy any semblance of sort of our typical biological social structure, right? To turn us into, it's so sad, but like to break us down into lonely little individuals only to assimilate us into some idea of a grand, you know, collective, and you're serving the greater population while losing any kind of real world connection. You know, Jesus said, love thy neighbor, right? I think the word neighbor is a good one. It's right there. It's the person across the street. It's really shameful. I go back and forth on how I feel about sort of suburbia, having grown up in it, where it almost feels like an ant colony, right? The patterns of it all.
Right. Insect structure. We all live in a hive.
That's why I was very interested in that idea of insectification, right? Insectification. That was in one of your interviews where, yeah, we are being reduced in some ways to behaving like a colony of insects, as opposed to what we should be, which is in essence a pack animal. You know, I resent the idea of being a herd animal. I think a pack is a better description, right? When you have a group of chimpanzees, you know, I'm not sure what they call it exactly, but it feels more like a pack than a herd.
Right. And the herd is herded.
Right.
Right. The notion of the pack suggests a kind of initiative.
Well, in a natural organization, a self-organization. You know, I think a lot of people have a misconception about what like alpha male means. It's not necessarily the strongest. It's typically in a wolf pack. And I, you know, this is from things I've read, things I've heard. Take it or leave it. You take it with a grain of salt. I'm not the expert, but I understand that in a wolf pack, it's generally the most reciprocal that is in charge. Like the male who tends and look, you know, tends is maybe not the right word, but looks after and like shows affection for the majority of his pack, but will still apply discipline or what have you. But apparently there's been some studies into like, you know, the alpha male spends more time grooming his fellow like pack members than he does punishing them, which is kind of counter to what we're sort of taught in popular culture. And so it's not about being the brawniest or the meanest or the most powerful. It's often more about cooperation. I think this is people have this idea of nature being, what do they say? You know, survival of the fittest, like the law of tooth and claw. And that's certainly a part of it, but there's way more cooperation in nature than people tend to believe. And so again, going back to like the spiritual battle at hand, if the forces of evil are trying to separate us, the only thing we can do is come together, right? And I think online communities help, but really without physical community in your immediate vicinity, it's only halfway there. If that.
Yeah, I think it's useful.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, sometimes the analogies of nature are useful, but I think it's also important to remember that we are not wolves and we're not even chimpanzees, we're human beings, and there are ways of relationship which are appropriate to us as human beings that are differential from other members of the animal kingdom, which gives us a place of incredible significance so far as the broader ecostructure goes. Now, you see, you have to embrace that significance with a sense of humility rather than arrogance or a presupposition that the objective is to dominate. This, I think, is an attitude of historically relatively recent emergence, right? This is basically the attitude of modernity, that science shall give us the tools to become, to quote Rene Descartes, lords and masters over nature. I guess I don't know where to go from here in the conversation. I was thinking a few conversational paragraphs ago about, well, I mean, you can sort of translate it into, well, I'm not really certain. There are things I could say, but I want to like make certain that I'm living in the integrity of the speech. It would be very easy, like, for example, to segue and then levy a critique of the elite at this moment.
I was thinking when you were talking earlier where, sort of like we're not wolves, right? And the question of hierarchy and power comes to mind, and it's why I'm attracted to sort of anarchistic thinking, in that it makes me very uncomfortable to be in a position of power over anyone else. And it makes me twice as uncomfortable probably to be in a sort of subjugated position where someone has power over me, you know, and it makes me think about, you know, I'm a believer in sort of cooperation. Like I said, I think humans are the most cooperative species. It's our greatest asset. And when it comes to cooperation and like how to sort of get shit done, the natural sort of the easy solution is to sort of let somebody be in charge. It's harder to be in sort of a more ambiguous like power structure. And it makes me wonder if, like, again, like boiling down our basic psychology, is there not a need for some level of like leadership?
Well, the thing about anarchism,
mm-hmm.
right, is it wants to assert that hierarchy is beneath our dignity, that we have a capacity as human beings to respond to the situation at hand in an appropriate manner that is not deformed by our excessively narrow self-interest, right? Hierarchy apologizes it for itself as an unpleasantness which is necessary to counter the frailty of our nature and our inclination to behave, or so it will assert, in unruly and harmful fashions, Right. Now, this is the catch 22 of it, right? This is why it's so hard to get out of this cycle. Because guess what happens? When you put people in a hierarchy and you constrain them, they're inclined to ultimately become unruly.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So then it sort of ends up as like this self-justifying dialectic, right? The more laws, the more criminals, that kind of a thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So the second main character in Player Piano is this like old friend of the, you know, of the main character who has basically quit his job and like just cast aside like all shackles of society, is like a total renegade, right? Has gone sort of feral as any human could go. And he's kind of tugging at the emotions of his friend who's still very much in the matrix, let's say. You know, he's part of sort of the managerial class. He's in the upper echelon of the corporation, and he's seen it go from being a, you know, a business with people working for it to a business with machines doing most of the work. And he's having a debate in his own mind about the nature of reality and what he's doing and how he's living and whether or not it's real or authentic or good. And his friend kind of comes along and is trying to prod him into going a little bit feral. And that's kind of a simplistic way of describing it, but you know, the subtle shift from sheep to wolf, if you will, if there is such a thing with people, to be a bit of a, you know, how'd you describe it, or how'd your the guy you interviewed describe it, becoming a cyber rebel, I think is the choice of words.
I think is what he used.
Techno rebel. I like
right.
it.
Right. And I think yeah. he got that term from Toefler, Toefler, who is an author who wrote a lot about technology that I haven't read. It's certainly a concept which I think I need to investigate more, right? Because we have to find some kind of relationship with these phenomena. We can't just jettison them because frankly that would, if we were to do it in an abrupt fashion, also create all kinds of harm which are inconsistent with what we want to actually achieve, right? And then sort of it's like inconvenient, but we have to acknowledge, don't we, that power is part of our lives, right? And mm-hmm. and like I have to make decisions of power in connection with, you know, my niece and nephew who are 2 years old and eight right. and two and nine respectfully, right? Or two and eight going on nine, right? You know, if they're going to do things, and sometimes, you know, like my nephew, I have to sort of physically restrain him. That's an exercise of power, right? So, or it's actually, it's a use of force is what it is. And, but then you can think of more adult situations where the resort isn't necessarily to force per se, but yeah, you as a business owner are in a power relationship with all your clients.
Yeah.
Right.
To some degree. Right.
And you got to make that conscious so that you don't fall prey to it. And so the challenge is our critiques of power cannot allow us to evade our responsibilities. We have to learn. I don't know. It's a real problem, right? It's a real problem. And I don't have the answer to it.
Well, in terms of like the client contractor relationship, you could just say, I suppose, service provider. But there is always a temptation to give up your own power for the sake of the paycheck. And I've just kind of lost my patience with doing that, frankly. So there have been a couple of instances this season where I kind of stood up for myself with clients. I won't get real detailed, but in essence, one of them like dug up everything and replanted it immediately after I'd put it all in the ground and basically killed everything in the process. And I kind of was just honest with her and said, you know, you shouldn't have done that. Like, this isn't going to work if there's not some trust. Like, I put everything in their proper place. And, you know, she's like just kind of OCD and wanted things to be in certain place. I don't know. But I didn't let her walk all over me. She said, like, well, you know, the customer's always right. And I'm like, well, if you think you can do it better than me, be my guest, you know. And I had to fire another client. She kind of pouted and walked away, but I hope she heard what I said, where it's like, you're paying me to do this right, and I can't help you if you mess with it too much. And I'm not just trying to bitch and moan, but it's a matter of sort of at a certain point, self-respect. And this other person that I fired as a client, they were just talking to me in a very, what I found to be disrespectful way, just rude. And I said, look, thanks. You know, I built their garden, I planted their garden, but I gave them their money back for the membership that I had signed them up for, just because I didn't want to deal with it. I'm like, I don't deserve to be talked to in this tone. And so there is something to be said for like going a little wild, or just like having your own sense of self-respect in this world, where when you look around and you see the way that people are trying to subjugate you for your own dignity, for your own self-respect, like you have to stick up for yourself and find a better way to live, right? A more authentic way to live, a less addicted way to live, you know, get out of the system as much as possible. And going back to maybe sort of the spiritual side of things, the occult, and I'm curious where you're at as far as like, are you ascribed to any certain religious tradition in any way, or, you know, this idea of like spiritual versus religious? That's, I mean, I know that's kind of open-ended, but to me, I'm very much inclined to go back to my roots as a Christian, but I was raised in sort of the cookie cutter, like McDonald's version of Christianity, and that doesn't necessarily appeal. So I'm curious where you're at, if you're willing to say.
I think that every major religious tradition has provided us with ways of relating to the sacred that are potentially advantageous. But they're not the same ways, so that they can be mutually enriching. So with respect to radical Christianity, there's like this, you can say there's a distinction between prophetic Christianity and Constantinian Christianity, Christianity which has been appropriated by the empire and which serves serves Caesar, as it were, right? I think that prophetic Christianity has given us a sense of the significance of the individual and the personal, which is somewhat uniquely powerful through the notion of God's incarnation. On the other hand, I think that this is another example. Buddhism, through its various contemplative practices, puts us in touch with facets of human experience which can be truly freeing. Buddhism can give you a capacity to escape the lies that you tell yourself, right? And so on, right? So what is consistent is that there is a domain, a threshold of existence, a transcendent ground or space, which the access to which is intimately connected with the realization of meaning. And the effective access of that space is predicated on a kind of surrender, or Islam, if you will, because that's what Islam means, incidentally. is surrender. The yearning is to control. The yearning is not to surrender. The temptation is to control. And the occult or occult orientations derive, I think, from exactly the indulgence of that yearning for control and manipulation. And there's a kind of paradox which arises with the personality that is fixated on the notion of control. The absolute authoritarian is also paradoxically inclined to a remarkable servility, even a slavishness. And you can see this operate concretely in relatively rigid command structures, where someone on one level of the command structure will exhibit just a brutally despotic orientation to the people beneath them, but when confronted with their superiors, is utterly supplicant, utterly docile, right? So my view of the matter, as far as elite strata go, is that these people are the majority of them who occupy the so-called commanding heights are generally personalities of incredibly authoritarian disposition, and thus are liable to the same sort of paradoxical duality. Now, what I think happens is that their craving for power is such that they are willing to surrender to something that is other than human in order to expand their power. And basically think that that's what happens. That sort of
making the deal with the devil.
Precisely like, and here I'm not just using that as a metaphor. Okay. I think that many people on in, I mean, who knows? Okay. I don't know that. That's just my opinion.
I agree. It goes back to what I was
in a certain narrow. It doesn't really matter that much, actually, because the solution is to just live in your own world. Like, I don't mean that. I don't mean like that solipsistically. Like, I mean, you know, it's your neighborhood. It's your, you know, neighbors. You establish relationships with them. And, you know, that's where you're going to really effectively combat, through quiet acts of heroism, the agendas from on high. But if you ask the on high in quotations, right? But if you ask my opinion, that I think that they do consort with energies of a demonic character. You know, there's different mythologies, you know, who knows what the actual reality of these energies are. I think that mythologies variously give names to these phenomena, but if they exist behind a veil so that we can only have a vague sense of their reality. And thus we have to be very circumspect about being too concrete, like, oh, that's the devil, or that's the Armada,
or that's the Mephistophelian.
You can come up with these demonologies and so forth. But you know, it's almost besides the point. The real point is kindness and love.
Right.
Kindness, almost, love, and surrender to that, the greater reality of the universe will have your back, if you like, when you live in accord with those principles. Does that answer your question?
It's sort of, well, certainly. I was gonna say, like, this weird, like, paradoxical nature of so many things, right? I've been very interested in the idea of duality for a long time, sort of everything having its equal and opposite, two sides, same coin. There's sort of inextricable interconnectedness with so many things. But I almost think part of the challenge is to transcend that, like, dualistic nature and, like, get to, like, a more pure nature. And I'm not sure if this will make total sense the way I'm saying it, but you know, you talked about in one of your interviews about sort of the weird connection between the seeking out of eternal life, right? The transhumanist impulse, and how it so often is held by people who are more than willing to kill to get what they want, right? Sort of the death cult in search of eternal life, which is ironic on its face, right? It's paradoxical. Eternal life, but willing to murder. I think, you know, I don't ascribe to the whole like adrenochrome fucking conspiracy theory, but I think there's something to be said for the, again, like it's metaphorical, but the vampire cannot come into your home uninvited.
That's right. True. I mean, I find that most metaphors end up mapping to a concrete reality as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But it takes me to the point of sort of spiritual consent. You may consent unwittingly to the eventual consequences, but without some sort of like spiritual guidepost, you're more susceptible to consenting to things that are against your best interests, if that makes sense. Like I think we have to be very careful what we spiritually consent to. Again, going back to voting and things like that. I'm not against voting as a whole, but I think it's cheap and wrong to vote for somebody you don't actually believe in simply because they are the lesser of two evils.
Right.
Give me someone worth voting for and I'll vote.
It's preferable to be silent, right?
I would prefer to be silent than to give consent and spiritual backing, you know, energetic sort of support to someone who is going to do evil with that, right?
Right. I mean, that's that, but you see, and I agree, it's it also points to why you need a more sort of delegate as opposed to representative democracy, right? Where the framework of representation necessarily gives rise to these dilemmas. In a delegate framework, they would still recur. There's nothing perfect, right? But, this is a kind of a technical point, right? But the liability of giving away your power to a personality who is a delegate is not as great as a representative, because a delegate is compelled to a very narrow range of options, right? They're supposed to carry out relatively specific instructions. There's still always space for discretion and the abuse of discretion, but it's just not as pronounced as it is under the current system, where the framework of representation more or less is employed as a buffer against an underlying oligarchy.
So the issue of hierarchy is at play, right? But I think there's a fine line between like natural fluid hierarchy and like a bureaucracy, right? Talking about the whole impulse to be a tyrant to those beneath you and a slave to those above you, that would not exist in a natural fluid kind of hierarchy where leaders are chosen based on competence and status can be lost very, very easily, right? You catch my drift. You know,
yeah.
The greater like hypothetical of, say, we managed to sort of be able and willing, you know, with the political will in our local communities to restructure things. How would we restructure? I agree that, like, I think what I'm hearing about the delegate versus the representative is it's easier to keep the delegate on point, on track with what people actually want. They're easier to get rid of, perhaps.
Well, the difference is that, yeah, the representative is theoretically supposed to exercise his vote in the best interest of his constituency. But he determines what the best interest of his constituency is. Mm-hmm. Okay. Whereas theoretically, the delegate is also tasked with servicing the best interest of their constituency, but they are not.
They're beholden to the common will.
They do not. Yeah. Okay. And the common will is not just that they were elected. Right.
Right. You know, right.
And that, as I understand the model differentially, it's
that, kind of semantics, but.
Right.
Right.
Well, it's not just semantics. It's like when you delegate, you give someone specific directions
to
undertake a given task, right? Like if there's going to be a vote on a specific piece of legislation and you send the delegate to cast the vote, the delegate casts what you tell them to cast, not what they think should be cast.
Right.
So.
Right.
It's the delegate is really a kind of vicar, where he's standing in vicariously for the voice of their constituency. Whereas a representative, you have faith that the representative will exercise their discretion without having to consult his constituents. He can even vote against what the constituency thinks is their best interest if he esteems that they are deluded in their orientation.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So at times I make fun of democracy because it's become a farce in our current sort of form of it. But local small scale democracy is certainly like practical and logical. I just don't know how far out, you know, what I would really hope for is and I think your guest said it well, like sort of a federation of autonomous sovereign sort of city states.
Right.
Right.
And that's sort of like the best bet.
Yeah.
Sort of dramatic decentralization.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't have a whole lot of other thoughts. It's kind of like, just funny. I think all this stuff is super connected, sort of technology, magic, if you will, spiritual magic and governance. Yeah.
Like a concluding point that I would, and then maybe you can respond and then we'll wrap it there. And that is, to what extent does technology conduce to greater democracy? And it's in as much as, at least the way it's unfolded, in as much as it decenters us, it places us at a distance from where we are concretely. Technology is almost anti-democratic. If democracy is something which is to be really exemplified on a more or less local level, extending to the global through sort of loose federations or confederations, then we have to really exhibit far more circumspection about using that technology. You can think of voting, even voting machines sort of indicate this, right? Mm-hmm. It's digital as opposed to actual concrete ballots. But
I think both have their limitations and their vulnerabilities. But I do think if we wanted truly like honest, unquestionably honest elections, like that technology does exist. It's called like blockchain. I mean, this problem was solved where we have a way of confirming without a shadow of a doubt that something has not been counterfeited, that it is authentic, that it was either put in this, you know, digital jar or that digital jar, if you catch my drift, right?
Yeah.
If we wanted to have direct, honest, technologically provable elections, we could do that. But what we have now is such a puppet show and there's so much like tradition behind it that isn't going to happen. I think it only happens on like a very, very local level. If you can get enough, like I said, political will in a local community to kind of restructure the town council and to employ like better, more secure election technology in the form of uncounterfeitable digital tokens. That's how it starts. And it goes to you know, your guest was talking about how like the local mint is sort of the ultimate goal, having a form of local currency that the economy, you know, works within. It's a tall order, but it is the only way to sort of strip those at the very, very top of the main levers of control that they have. If we stop using the US dollar, if we start using other things.
Well, I have to say, this is just something where I have to do more discernment, but there's an ambiguity to blockchain and similar modalities. And again, I just need to do more learning about it. But my concern with anything that rises too far beyond the analog is that it demands a sort of technical facility that is going to be the province of only a few people. And
not necessarily. I mean, that's the interesting thing with like Bitcoin is it's very decentralized as far as if you run what's called a node, you know, it's kind of like you were talking about it on one of your episodes where right now we have massive server farms, we have internet providers, but if we can start acting as our own server and have Urbit, sort of.
Right. Urbit is the, sorry, go on.
I was going to say have more sort of independent networks, more decentralized networks. Like that is kind of how Bitcoin already works and how blockchain was designed to work, where thousands of computers are simultaneously confirming transactions. So it's an open ledger shared by 1,000 different nodes, where every individual computer sees that the transaction occurred, and it keeps it basically trustless is the term they use, where it's, like I said, just uncounterfeitable because it's so radically decentralized. Right. Everybody with a node is checking whether or not it's authentic or not. So that makes sense. And it's beyond my technological knowledge. Right. That's just the basic mechanics, but yeah.
I mean, it's just a different way of handling operating system questions and things like that. And there are examples like Odyssey runs like that. And it's not just Bitcoin. It's not just Bitcoin. There's Ethereum.
I mean, it's how torrents used to work, or I guess still do.
Urbit. I think you might be interested in investigating that. So this is sort of ties into the technological rebel sort of thing. And one of the thing about the technological rebellion is creating a new internet that isn't as amenable to the agendas of the power.
Removing the bottlenecks of control, the power centers, right? Taking back a little bit of power at a time until we have sort of, I hate to use the word, but like an equitable distribution of technological power, if that makes sense. Yeah.
The one thing that is requisite upon people who I think move to the use of these decentralized technologies is that they demand greater engagement, right? You know, to really navigate Bitcoin or Urbit, you have to take a kind of ownership and responsibility for your relationship with the software that is, at least in terms of initially the case, more demanding than that which is required for you to just turn on your laptop and jump onto Google. Right.
Right.
So it's also about inculcating in people a sense that they just have to be willing to endure, at least for a time, a measure of inconvenience for a better world and a better situation.
I think that's always the case. I mean, it doesn't happen all by itself. Like a better world is not just going to fall in our laps, right? If we look at the trends of our culture and society and government, it tends to trend in a negative direction. So, you know, there needs to be an opposing force. There needs to be an equal and opposite reaction. We need, if things have become, again, food is my main interest. I've learned about technology as a necessity because I recognize the power of it. It's like podcasting is a great example of radical decentralization. Instead of us all listening to, instead of us listening to CNN, we have 1,000 different shows to choose from, which are generally infinitely better quality than what you get on cable, right? They had a stranglehold on information, and we broke it up from the ground up, from the grassroots. And that's only one, that's one sector of the economy. But like I said, food is critical. We need more local farms. We need more farmers markets. We need more backyard gardens. You know, I think about how Jeff Lawton, one of the great permaculture, Bill, I think it was the original Bill Mollison. He was like one of the original permaculture guys, kind of wrote the original books. And he has a quote saying that, like, the most subversive, radical thing you can do is grow food. And I would say he might be halfway correct, but I think maybe Jesus actually had it better, where really the most radical thing you can do is just love your neighbor. And that maybe includes growing food so that you have food to share with your neighbor if they need it, right? Everybody's got to eat. Everybody's got to drink clean water. And if we can't help ourselves, we can't help nobody else. That's kind of my end all be all point for the most part.
I think that we can leave it there.
Sure. Sure.
Now, man. So, I'm going to, because we could just start a whole new conversation there right at the end about food and,
Bill Gates
purchased all this land. Mm-hmm. And I mean, that happened about a year ago now or something like that. But
it's been happening. It's been happening for a long time.
And, there should be a counterpoint. Like, no one should own that kind of land, right? Mm-hmm, it's not his land.
Well, okay? Frankly, do you own it if you can't defend it? I mean, that's my practical brain saying, who knows what the future entails, but Bill Gates cannot feasibly defend all the farmland he has acquired.
Of course.
If people want to reacquire their ancestral lands, they may just have the opportunity to do so at some point.
Well, I don't know about
that's that. A whole nother topic too.
That's a whole other thing right there. Right.
Yeah.
So we're going to just have to put that in, for the next time, as it were,
put a pin in it. Yep.
For the time being anyway.
Yeah.
Michael. So thank you. Hey, and,
my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Rock and roll. We put this up within the next day or so on my channel, probably pretty quickly, and send you the files, and you're welcome to use them as you see fit. So
right on. All I need is the audio, but
rock and roll.
Awesome, man.
I don't know if I could send them independently. I think I can, but either way, I'll get it to you. So
okay. All right.
All right. I'll talk to you soon.
All right.
Ciao for now.